Good morning, and welcome to, is this officially our last interim?
Yes.
Committee for the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And today we're continuing our informational hearings, and then we will be adopting committee bills at some point during today's session. As you can see, we have a pretty full agenda, but certainly hope to move through this in a timely manner. First up, we've been doing a lot of work on the bottle bill over the past few sessions, as I'm sure you all know. And we'd like to hear an update from the folks who are operating the bottle redemption centers. We've asked John Anderson from the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative to be here today. And I think, John, you're also going to have the grocers come up and add to that. Great. Well, welcome and come on up.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning.
Mr. Committee Member. For the record, my name is John Anderson. I'm president of Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. And I've got a handout here for you. Hopefully you'll get here momentarily that just gives you an update on our progress with the bottle drop redemption centers. And I'll kind of go through it quickly. And feel free to ask any questions that you might have. So as you probably know, we opened our first two centers in 2010 and 2011. So the one's been open for 3 years now in October, and the second will be open for 3 years this January. And those both operated under a concept with a 1.5 mile radius of participating retailers, and the retailers within that radius no longer accepted containers back. And we had a great success with that. I think from a consumer standpoint, we saw volumes go up dramatically from what had been going through the participating grocery stores before. They stopped taking cans and bottles back to what was being returned through our redemption centers. And so last session, we requested and received approval for a pilot project to open a center that had two convenience zones, an inner and an outer zone. And the inner zone was within a 1.5 mile radius of participating retailers, and the outer zone was within 1.5 miles in a 3 mile radius. And so we opened that in the South Salem area in March of this year. And it has been extremely successful as well, at least measured in terms of the amount of volume that we're seeing come back to the center compared to what was coming back to the participating grocery stores prior to opening. And I've just got some statistics there listed under the experience with bottle drop centers that you can see maybe down on the very bottom, the last bullet point, or maybe second to last bullet point. Combined, the three sites that we have open are doing almost 7% of the state's volume. That gives you some perspective. There's 3,000 return locations around the state, and the three we have open are doing 7%. The percentage of returns to these centers relative to what was going back to the participating grocery stores before at Wood Village, we're doing 250% more than was going back to the grocery stores in Oregon City, 153%, and now in Salem, 132%, and that number's probably gone up a little bit from when I updated this. So by all measures in terms of consumer convenience and consumer acceptance, we're seeing positive results. On the second page there, I've just gone through our Easy Drop bag program, which has been very well received by consumers. We have almost 25,000 Oregonians who have signed up for the bottle drop accounts to date. And they have currently banked about $383,000 in returns that are just sitting in their accounts. Many come in, but or new people take money out, but they also are putting money in, and that number continues to grow. So we think it's a program that is very well received, and as we envision expanding it around the state, we think that it could make a significant impact in consumer return patterns and behaviors. And we did some a semi-scientific survey of our bottle drop customers. So we sent a survey out to our 24,000 plus account holders and asked them some questions. And one of them was what they were doing with their containers prior to signing up for a bottle drop account. And about a quarter of them said that they were either putting them in the garbage or putting them out on the curb. And obviously the curb is a good program compared to the garbage, but not doesn't reach the level of recyclability as through a single stream return to retail bottle drop or bottle bill type program. So in any case, I think there's some substantial evidence to suggest that people that when they have a choice of using the green bags choose to do that where they may have abandoned returning containers entirely where they had to go to the grocery store and do it before. So we think that's a good thing moving forward. So what we want to do is continue to expand under the pilot project model around the state, and we are seeking approval of legislation that would allow us to do that with a minor shift in the radius of the inner radius and the outer radius in hopes of fitting the return patterns a little bit closer. And I've attached to the handout that you have a map that shows some purple, blue, and green dots. And those dots represent bottle drop account holders. This is not all of them because many of our account holders sign up with a P.O. box instead of a street address. So if it's a P.O. box, we can't chart that. But these dots represent by center. So the pink is the Wood Village Center, and the blue is the Oregon City, and the green is South Salem. And you can see the distribution, how far people are coming to return their containers. And part of this we recognize is there aren't other places to go. So if people want to use the service, they have to travel some distance. But in our experience with people signing up, there's so many reasons why somebody goes by a location, either work or another business they frequent or family or whatever the case is. We have people that are signing up and coming in from farther distances. So we want those radius, the inclusion of the participating retailers to reflect the consumer traffic patterns. And specifically to the issue of what has happened at the stores that are in the outer zone today and taking 24 containers back, their volumes have dropped over 80%. They are getting a few returns back, but very, very minimal. And I was talking to Joe this morning. We haven't heard any complaints from consumers on that issue that they can't take back 144 at those stores. And Joe had told me that he hasn't heard any either. So maybe you can speak a little more to that.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead, Joe, and then I'm sure we'll have some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Haas, for the record, Joe Gilliam, Northwest Grocery Association. John's correct. We have it's been very pleasant. Anytime you make a change like this, you expect a kind of a flurry of complaints about change, and we just haven't had them. Very, very positive comments at the stores. They like the redemption center, and they also are commenting how they like the rooms out of the grocery store. So we're getting kind of a double compliment on our project. So we're very pleased. Grocers are very pleased. Consumers seem to be responding well. Our volumes are up where we have redemption centers, and that's a real positive sign. And when you see these radiuses and where people are coming from, it's really positive as we can infill those as we move forward. So it's working very well right now. I have presented to you LC Draft 2320 what we've been working on. This is the next step, we believe, in what we learned over the last year and a half. As we put the Salem Center together, it was obviously a lot of data collecting. That's why it was a pilot project. And we did learn several things, and the draft here reflects a couple things we believe we need to get at to make this thing work as we go forward. The first page really codifies that the pilot project was done in Section 1. In Section 2, the bill allows more redemption centers based on this pilot project. So it's just saying you can go forward.
And I just want to clarify that this is one of the legislative concepts that we're looking at introducing. You can see on the list, there's actually two relating to the bottle bill. So what you are reading from right now, correct, is LC 2320. Right. So it's not a bill yet. I just want to make sure for folks who are listening, it's a legislative concept.
It's a legislative concept.
Right. So if they're going, well, what's
thank you for the correction. And this really is a revamp of the pilot project bill passed last session, but adding in what we've learned and how to take it forward since the pilot project was a limited, you know, certain approach. Just want to respect your time here, just kind of give you an idea. Page 2, it raises the amount that we take in from 300 to 350. We believe the capacity is there. It describes the services. One thing we did run into, as we looked at non-participating retailers, they were to provide similar services. This is a language we put in on page 3. The OLCC felt, the legal counsel felt, they didn't know how to enforce that. They didn't know what similar services meant. And they asked us to be more specific. What would it mean? So this section here begins to outline what it would mean. If you decide not to participate and you want to do your own thing, what would be the similar services? In that section, it talks about hand counting and also making available a drop-off and a counting system like the bag drop that we have in the redemption center. So we're just being as specific as we can so they don't have to guess as we go out. Rite Aid came on board, had never participated before. They came on board in South Salem. We were very pleased that they came on. They did it voluntarily. Others just did not come on, and the OLCC didn't pick like enough teeth to bring them into a decision. So they're not providing the services we're providing out there. And so we came up short on our pilot project in that area. Down in lines 13, convenience zones go from 1.5 miles, 1.5 to 3 miles, extended to 2 and 3.5 miles. So it's a half mile extension of each one of the rings. On the third page, it continues the language in terms of providing the similar services as the redemption center if you're a non-participating retailer, and sets a standard for reverse vending machines that you have to have a minimum of 2 or 1 for every 500,000 units you sell. You'd have to have an RVM as part of your makeup.
And this was not in the original?
That was not in the original. That's all new language, Madam Chair. It's to the goal of providing, defining what similar services were. And then at the very bottom in Section 3, it brings the existing three redemption centers would be under this law as well. So the ones we already have out there would fall in line with a standard law and then approval date.
So the one thing I have heard, the feedback I've heard, and it's more been in the rural communities, is, and I see that on your handout, let me just pull this up here, that you have put down here that you anticipate, under moving forward, rolling out one new center every 3 months. So that seems pretty ambitious, considering it's been, we've had three in what, 2.5, 3 years?
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. So the only feedback I've heard so far is from areas that are not serviced, and they want to know when, especially in rural communities. So if you can speak to that, gentlemen, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I think we've been spending the last 2.5, 3 years trying to perfect or as close to perfect the model as we can, not just from a consumer convenience standpoint, but frankly from a financial standpoint. Mm-hmm. It's an expensive program, but we think we've got a model that is sustainable for us that are funding it. And so it's taken us a certain amount of time to get where we are today and believe that we've got something we can put forward and sustain it financially and from an operation standpoint. And now, frankly, we're waiting for approval to move forward legislatively with the Salem concept. We like it. It's worked well. It's what we need to do financially. And so we've got 5 or 6 sites right now that we're negotiating LOIs on, and they all have a legislative contingency in them, subject to your approval. So,
and where do you anticipate? I don't, you know, want to give out too much, but what parts of the state? Maybe you can. Is this all still up and down the I-5 corridor, or are you?
Well, we're looking at Northwest Portland, Northeast Portland, Eugene, Medford, and Bend.
And then I don't see, unless I missed it here, which could be, as far as how many people are employed at these facilities?
In each center, we're staffing them with between 6 and 8 employees, and then beyond that, we have the support staff that oversee groups of stores. And of course, we only have 3 at this point, so we don't have a lot of those positions yet, but we anticipate them. So I think by the time we're done statewide, if we look at doing 40, 45 of these centers, we'll probably have 325 employees that are involved in operating the centers.
And I'm assuming you're typically recruiting from local
absolutely
labor pools.
Yep.
Did you have any questions,
sure.
Senator? Yep.
First, congratulations on the success. I never had any doubts. You're saying that by a margin of about 27%, more people are redeeming than used to under the old go to Safeway and put your bottles through?
Well, I guess statistically it was 27% of the respondents said that prior to using bottle drops. So you know, we have, it varies a little bit, but we have between maybe 40% of the users are using the bottle drop, the bag drop feature. 60% are still using traditional return, the RVMs, the reverse vending machines. So we pulled those that we have addresses for, email addresses for, which is the 40% using the Easy Drop Bag program. And of that 40%, 27% said prior to signing up for an account, I was either putting them in the garbage or I was putting them on the curb. And I realize there's a substantial difference between there, but in terms of, as we looked at what the redemption rates are within the bottle bill and trying to improve those, we would like to capture both of those streams if we can.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, in all instances where you take the volumes of the stores in those 3 areas where we have them, the volume is now higher at the redemption center in total volume in that area.
That's right.
It went up when you shut the retail stores down and put it in the redemption center.
Yeah,
the numbers went up.
And I think that's outstanding. And I don't think you mentioned this, is in those stores, you don't have that mess of, you know, crap that you know, historically had at the very places where we buy our food.
The center has the Oregon City Salem, or Oregon City Safeway store is a brand new store. It's from ground up that they built. And it's the first store that has not had a bottle room in over 35 years. Mm-hmm. And the applications were over double for transfers to that store from store directors who wanted to take that store for the very reason that they didn't have a bottle room to manage.
I didn't notice on your map here that some of the red dots were over on the Washington side.
Yeah, and we had talked about that, gentlemen, and one of the concerns was about how we can have better control from people from north of my district who do not pay the deposit, that we can control that. So can you maybe, that's an excellent point, Senator, if you can maybe touch upon that a little bit?
Well, one of the things that we know is some of the points, I would say certainly east of Portland, the major grocery stores, say you get out into Cascade Locks, Stevenson area on the Washington side, Cascade Locks in Oregon, but Stevenson, the major grocery centers are either Hood River or Wood Village. And we know a lot of people live and drive in and work in Wood Village. So there is a natural expectation that people are shopping in Oregon, buying, paying the deposits, even though they may live in Washington. When you get over into Vancouver, I'm sure a lot of that occurs. People live in Washington and work in Oregon and perhaps shop where close to where they work. But we know there's also a fair number of people that are bringing containers over that they haven't paid a deposit on. I think the good news in Oregon's system is the financial harm and responsibility lies with the distributor in that, because the distributor ends up paying back to the grocery retailer where the container was returned, or the bottle drop center where the container was returned, a deposit when a deposit wasn't collected to start with. But we are the distributors and we represent them, so the harm stays within us. And so there has to be a point where we look at it and say the options to correct that are worth the value that of the harm. And I don't think we're to that point. We try to, when we see someone out of state bringing containers in, we know their address, we know their return patterns, and if it seems excessive, as in bags and bags and bags every day, we call them up as an account holder and we explain how the Oregon bottle bill works. And most of the time they just disappear. Maybe they come back under a different name, but the pattern eventually we catch. The other folks we talk to say, oh yeah, I shop at the Walmart in Wood Village because I work, at the
big industrial area,
truck stop or whatever it is. And so those customers are fine. So I think from a financial standpoint, we are the ones being harmed. But at this point, we're nowhere near pushing 100% redemptions in the state, unfortunately. So it's not an issue that we're putting a lot of effort into.
And speaking about which, and gentlemen, we're going to have to wrap up because we're going to run short on time. But we do have another legislative concept, 950. We'll be voting on here shortly, that relates to enforcement and also audit provisions, because when we wrote the original law for OLCC is actually doing the oversight, we realized they didn't have the audit provision. So I'm sure you've probably seen that. And
just saw it this morning. So.
Yeah, just saw it this morning. Yeah. Generally speaking, I would say we have nothing to hide. If folks are more comfortable auditing us, I'm okay with that.
Okay. Grocers are quite enthusiastic, though, about moving forward. It's going well, and this piece of legislation is important to us just to make it so we can do 3 or 4 year.
Well, thank you for coming and presenting an update. I know we'll be hearing more after the session starts, and thank you for your hard work. I know there's a lot of work to be done yet, but I think we're moving in the right direction and certainly making progress, so it's exciting to see this happen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Moving on to water, we have an update on Senate Bill 1010, which is the Agricultural Water Quality Program, and we have the Director and Assistant Director for Department of Agriculture looking quite festive this morning.
Aren't we?
Did you coordinate before you? So anyway, welcome.
Good morning, ladies. Madam Chair.
Yes. And I just wanted to say a few words before you launch into the update. We had for folks in the audience and listening, we had an update in September on our progress in Oregon on the Clean Water Act. And I asked the agencies, the major agencies that are implementing the Clean Water Act authority in Oregon to make a presentation and where we are, and I've been working with the department over the past year on ways that we can improve some of our programs, all the agencies, not just targeting ODA. We're going to hear from forestry today as well. But certainly want to thank you both for your leadership. I know this has been a long road to hoe, and we're not quite there yet, but that's why you're here today, to let us know about the progress. And just want to say we appreciate all the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture, with me, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director. And with your introduction, I just want to also commend my staff and the work that's been done really over the last year on the Agricultural Water Quality Program. And I'm here to say I think we're making incredible strides in moving to a more focused and strategic program. Lot of work, a lot of conversations, a lot more work to come, but I'm very excited about where we're going and really the opportunity to do a better job of documenting and sharing the story in terms of the good work that's being done on the ground by farmers and ranchers in our state. So just a little bit more detail in terms of what's going on and where we think we're going. Since we were before you in September, we've had two Board of Agriculture meetings, and this has been a topic on their agenda, very lengthy and very good discussions around the Ag Water Quality Program. The staff in the program have been doing some very intensive strategic planning work, and they're bringing key issues forward to the Board to kind of lay out for the Board and getting feedback from them, and it's been great dialogue and very helpful direction from our board. We also had a Water Quality Advisory Committee meeting a couple of weeks ago where we also had, I think, really, really good discussion in terms of kind of the direction that options in terms of moving forward and feedback from that group, which is made up of a very wide variety of interested partners in our agricultural water quality program. In addition, a lot of conversation with the soil and water conservation districts in the state, and these are just incredibly important partners for us in this program. We would not be successful in the Ag Water Quality Program without the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. So a lot of conversation with them about how we move forward together. And concern from the districts in terms of the fact that they've not been the regulatory hat, and they would be worried about a change in the program that would put them more in a regulatory role. And I think we've heard that message loud and clear from the districts, and so we're really trying to structure something moving forward which does not put them in a regulatory position, and we continue to rely on them for education, outreach, and actual project implementation on the ground. Other stakeholders that we've had conversations with, the federal NRCS program, which has also really shifted their program to identify focus areas that they're working in, and which is one of the things that we're talking about in our program. And so I think some opportunities to coordinate with them and potentially match up those focus areas so we can get more bang for the limited dollars that are available to do this work. And then just many, many other stakeholders that we continue to be in conversation with. As you know, the program, the Ag Water Quality Program up to this point in time has been, I would describe, more opportunistic. So taking advantage of individuals that want to do work, picking the low-hanging fruit off the tree and doing lots of projects on the ground. And we think the projects have been very successful, but the challenge has been documenting any kind of collective impact that an individual project has in terms of eventually improving water quality. So in looking at our program, we feel that we need to be much more strategic with the program. We've got limited resources. We recognize that. We've got to focus those resources. We need to prioritize where we do our work, and through monitoring, both use monitoring to help us identify focused areas as well as monitoring to document the success of the projects on the ground. Kind of the key areas that we've been looking at within the program with our area rules and our biennial reviews, how we can streamline our processes so we can free up more staff time, take staff time away from kind of that planning document kind of work and allowing them to do more work on the ground to get results on the ground and really focus in those prioritized areas. As I had mentioned, a lot of effort around the relationship with our soil and water conservation districts, and as the program evolves, clearly being able to understand what is their role and what is the role of the Department of Agriculture. The importance of monitoring, and I'm thrilled that the governor's recommended budget has quite an extensive monitoring package funded in it with multiple state agencies. We're just one of those. Forestry, DEQ, OWEB are all critical partners, and we are in very in-depth conversations in terms of how we as state agencies move forward in terms of an integrated and enterprise monitoring approach. So that's also going to be very critical for our part of the program. And then finally, the key area around compliance. And we've been a complaint-based program in the Ag Water Quality Program. And a lot of the discussions that we've had with the stakeholders have been kind of evolving into moving towards what we call strategic compliance. So moving away from just complaint-based to a more strategic approach that could be something that the department really takes the lead on. And so what would that look like? I think where we're coming to is we're defining the questions very well, and the next step is really to figure out the answer to those. So as an example, in strategic compliance, if we pick a focus area to work on, how do we choose a focus area? How many do we choose? If we're doing work in that area, what do we do about compliance in the focus area? Do we give kind of a window of time to allow producers to come along or not? What do we do when we continue to get complaints and they come in and they're not from a focus area? How do we, you know, divide up resources to deal with those kinds of things? So I think we're really clarifying the questions that we need to have answered now, and I think next steps moving forward, it will be answering those questions, really putting a framework on where we're moving the program forward, continued conversations with all of the stakeholders that are interested in the program, and I'm very optimistic. I think when I was here in September, I felt that we would really have that program kind of redefined and where we were moving forward in a year. I think we're on track for that, and knock on wood, potentially even a little bit sooner if things continue to go well. So we're pleased with where we're moving. It has been an incredible amount of time and effort, as I mentioned. Kudos to the staff. Kudos especially to Lisa, who's been spending probably more than half of her time on water quality lately. And so I think the fruits of those efforts are definitely showing.
Okay, thank you. Lisa, did you want to add anything before we take questions?
No, we're happy to take questions. I think Director Koba covered the progress. Thank you.
Did you have any questions? Just had a couple for either of you, but thank you for the update, and I appreciate the work that you're doing, and I know that it's a lot of work, but hopefully we will see the fruits of your efforts in the long run for all the citizens of the state. And we do know there's a lot of good things happening out there as well that I think we would be better served by hearing more about those efforts. Simultaneously, as far as time frame, do you have a sense of, I know you said you think less than a year, do you think in the next few months? And then are there specific actions that the board needs to take? Are there approvals? Are there, do you see legislative changes, rule changes? Is this going to be more of a policy change? How do you anticipate making those adjustments, I would
right.
say. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I think we felt that we clearly have the authority to move in the direction that we're going. We don't anticipate needing any kind of statutory change. Potentially looking at some rule changes with the program, but I don't think we're quite there yet. At the last board meeting, the board basically committed to considering a resolution at their next meeting, which is going to be in early March, that would really kind of give board direction to the agency in terms of where they would like to see us moving with the program. And I think it's very much in line with what you had mentioned or what I had described to you just a minute ago. In terms of rollout and really having changes on the ground, I still would say September before we're there. I think staff could be aiming for potentially work on the ground changes coming this summer, but I would say my initial commitment of having kind of made those adjustments and everything in place and rolling, we're probably looking at next September.
Okay. And the other, I just wanted to comment on, as far as the monitoring, I agree. You know, it's something I've been sort of, I don't want to say harping on for a long time, but certainly as you deal with many, many agencies that have similar challenges as far as how we can prioritize, I think having a coordinated monitoring program and is the right direction and fits in well with the integrated resource strategy, which we're going to hear in a little bit on that. So I'm really pleased, and especially in times of diminishing resources, I think we have to do a better job at coordination. And certainly, I know you work very closely with SWCDs, and as a former SWCD employee, very well aware of the great programs that are offered there. We are looking at, as you know, lottery reductions, so a little concerned about how that's going to affect the ability of both watershed councils and SWCD, because we would be remiss if we didn't mention that watershed councils do a lot of work also with landowners and helping them implement programs that improve water quality. Last question I have is in regards to our fish recovery plans, and I know that's ODF&W's purview, but part of also why we're doing this is to make sure that we're on track for fish recovery. So have you been looking at strategically areas that we want to target to help meet those goals for salmon recovery, especially along the coastal areas?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. Senator Dingfelder, members, those are the discussions we're in right now. in terms of how we would prioritize looking at some of the statewide priorities and how that fits in with ODFW fish recovery plans, how that fits in with TMDLs and 303 delisted streams, how that fits in with NRCS and their strategic investments that they're making, so that we can identify the places where our work best fits in terms of backing up and providing that role as a regulatory backstop to help move people along to make the changes that need to be made for water quality improvement. And so we're still early in those discussions, but that definitely is part of the thought process that we're going through, is how do we align resources and programs and integrate them to deliver a full suite of services around water quality, and how do we best fit to augment that process?
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate you being here today. I'm sure you'll be coming back during the session to provide further updates, perhaps around the time of the March Board of Ag meeting. Perfect. And at that point, we may want to have some stakeholders come up too, and or possibly some Board of Ag members, and come talk a little bit, because I'd like to hear their perspectives on it as well. So thank you both, and
thank you.
Hope you have a good holidays. Okay, next we are shifting a little bit before we go back to water, and we're going to hear an issue that was a request at one of our members who couldn't be here today, and that would be Senator Przanski. Do you want to say anything about this issue?
No, I would just have Mr. Lester come up.
Okay, so actually, Lisa, I think you're coming back up for this. Okay. We have Mr. Lester, Lisa Hansen, the Deputy Director, again, of Department of Ag, and then we have also Dale Mitchell from the Department of Ag. Okay, yes, we have a few members that are missing in action, and so they're going to miss out on this presentation as well.
Good morning.
Hey, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Lester. I'm a homeowner in the rural Cottage Grove area, now retired and enjoying it. And Senator Przanski invited me here.
And he couldn't be here today, unfortunately, because he...
Right, yeah, he's got probably some prosecutorial duties.
Yes.
That he'd rather be here, I'm sure. But at any rate, he suggested I come and speak with you about a personal experience that I had involving personal injury to myself regarding a mole gopher burrowing animal explosive device that I sustained injury in the beginning of 2009. And in a nutshell, it's the device that injects propane oxygen mixture into unseen burrows and then ignited, and I just so happened to be in a vicinity, close proximity, with no ear protection, and did some inner ear damage and some partial hearing loss. And it appears that this device in practice, when we all, including law enforcement, looked into it, very unfamiliar, kind of new, no one really knew what to do with it. So I guess my purpose for being here is to inform you and to see whether or not there's any state involvement to regulate it, warnings. Of course, DOA has control over licensees, of course, and that shouldn't be any problem at all, probably isn't. But I find that what's fallen in the cracks is the retail market. It's wide open for anyone to purchase and use based on an owner manual. And it's been proven since my experience that it's happened. Whether injury has been sustained, I'm not sure, but I know of one incident with a former customer in quite an affluent area, as a matter of fact, doctors, lawyers, very intelligent people. A private homeowner purchased one, traumatized the whole neighborhood to the point where the whole group of doctors, lawyers, ended up on this gentleman's porch and demanded that he cease, and they actually had to threaten legal action to get him to stop. So in a nutshell, I guess it is a probably an item that will happen again based on history of our human race. Sense of judgment can be impaired at times. So that's really why I'm here, to see whether or not any sort of attention should be directed towards this by the state to prevent it from happening again. And I have some handouts that I think everyone does or will have. And my contact info is there if anyone has any questions in the future or now.
Thank you, Mr. Lesser. First of all, this is the first time that this issue has come to my attention in the 12 years of being in the legislature. However, I think we have the Department of Ag here to talk a little bit more about what the current regulations are, and then certainly this is something that we can look into. So maybe you can provide some background and on this use of this device, and certainly enlighten us on how we can make sure that this is safe for all users.
For the record, Lisa Hansen.
In the area, it sounds like.
Deputy Director with the Department of Ag, and with me is Dale Mitchell, who is in our pesticide management program. I think what we'll do is I'll have Dale talk a little bit about how EPA initially looks at these type of devices, and then what historically has happened in terms of Oregon and how they fit into the current Oregon law.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Dale Mitchell, the Oregon Department of Agriculture Program Manager, overseeing the compliance and enforcement in the pesticides program. As Deputy Director Hansen said, a little bit of background and history. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency enacted the federal regulations affecting the sales, use, and distribution of pesticide products. At the time, they had actually considered devices. Now, a pesticide product is normally what we would consider as a toxicant, a material that is designed to control, repel, mitigate. So those are the most common under the definition of a pesticide. However, the definition of a pesticide could include a device, and US EPA back in 1976 actually provided some clarification in the Federal Register to distinguish between a device. And as the testimony that we have heard, the propane rodent controls would be considered as a device, more so as not defined as a pesticide, as a toxicant. Now, in the state of Oregon, we did enact the Oregon Pesticide Control Regulations, Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 634. And when we had adopted, we had modeled it after federal regulations, we had actually adopted a definition of device. Now, since the enactment of the Oregon Pesticide Regulations, our focus has really been on pesticide products that would be made of a substance. This situation is the first situation that our agency has become aware of where an actual injury has occurred with the use of a device, a pesticide control device. Reviewing the statutory authority within our agency, within the statutes that administer. Certainly the definition of device is in there. It does provide the agency the authority to register these devices. And during the registration process, certainly it would allow the opportunity to consider the instructions of the device. Are they adequate to prevent injury to individuals with the use? As I had mentioned, this is the first situation that our agency has been made aware of an actual injury associated with the device. The circumstance that the testimony was provided on the incident, Mr. Lester unfortunately was still in the treatment area. The applicator certainly did not provide enough judgment, and the device was ignited. The instructions on that particular device do provide instructions for applicators to provide alert that clear the area and notice to individuals that may be in the area. But certainly it was an unfortunate circumstance. But I do feel that the agency does have the statutory authority to take into consideration the registration as well as the monitoring of these devices.
So it sounds like you're going to be looking at this in an expedited manner.
Yes, Madam Chair, again, this being the first incident, certainly we'll take it into review, look at the nature of the circumstance and the use so that it allows enough protection for public.
Lisa, did you want to add something?
Chair Dingfelder, I think as we look at this, this would take a change in administrative rule. There's some cost associated with it, and that would all be taken into consideration. There are other devices like this. It can range from a mousetrap to the noise cannons used in a vineyard-type situation. And so determining, given this is the first situation, how or if these should go through a review process with the department, I think, needs some additional consideration given the resources involved in doing that as well.
I understand that, but a couple things. One, it sounds like if these devices are being sold in the state, we need to make sure that we're protecting public health and safety as well, number one. And two, I don't know how much education is required by the retailer for the purchaser, and that's something I would suggest that you look into, because obviously I'm sure that it would not be done intentionally, but when you're talking about something as severe as hearing loss or potential injury, we need to make sure that we're, you know, protecting other folks. Otherwise, you're going to be looking at lawsuits, and I don't think we want to have that course of action. I think where we can be preventative is much preferred. So anyway, I don't know if you want to make any closing comments and
I fully expected DOA to be right on top of this, as I've been told, and I appreciate that. Very possibly, if I can be of assistance during that process for review, feel free to contact me. I just really feel strongly that it will happen again if some sort of regulation or enhanced warnings from the manufacturer aren't elevated, but I'll make myself available for any kind of help.
Great. Well, thank you for bringing this issue to our attention. I know that Senator Przanski will be following up on this to make sure that it moves forward in a expeditious manner, and I do encourage you to realize that you have to review, you know, all these, but it's for the safety of not only the users but folks who are in the area as well. And I realize this is an important issue. Certainly, we're not saying, you know, that these should be banned, but certainly I think we need to make sure that they're being safely used and applied. So thank you very much for coming
here
today.
Thank you. I might add Senator Przanski injected a little humor and said if it went so far as to any legislation to label it as the Caddyshack. So,
we probably got more questions about that on our agenda today than almost any other item we've had in a while. So thank you very much for being here today. Okay, next we're going to hear an update on the Integrated Water Resources Strategy implementation, and we have, I thought we had Richard Whitman. I saw him poke his head in. Oh, he's hiding back there. Okay. We have Richard Whitman from the Governor's Office. We have Phil Ward, the Director of the Water Resources Department, and this is like the Katie Day, and Katie Kober from Department of Agriculture. Except I notice you did not color coordinate with your colleagues over here.
But look at Phil's tie.
Yeah, I did see the tie.
I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of hopeless. Yeah.
It's okay. He's got the Hanukkah tie on, the blue. So there you go. Now you're
That's right.
Yeah, balanced up there. Morning.
Good morning, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Richard Whitman, Governor's Natural Resources Advisor, and I have with me today
Phil Ward with the Oregon Water Resources Department.
Katie Koba, Department of Agriculture.
And we're here to talk to the committee to give a brief presentation on proposals in terms of moving Oregon forward in terms of water resources development, implementation of the Oregon Integrated Water Resources Strategy, which is a great accomplishment on the part of the Oregon Department of Water Resources and the Water Resources Commission over the last couple of years to put that first strategy for Oregon together in terms of where we're headed in the future for water resources in the state. As you all know, we face enormous challenges in terms of water resources. with a growing population, with the effects of climate change and diminishing snowpack, with the water, some of the water quality problems that you just heard about, the problems with the sustainability of our fisheries resources, just some real challenges. And water is really part of who we are as Oregonians. It's part of how we define ourselves. We all care deeply about water. And the fact that we now finally have a strategy that sets out a vision and a future for where we're headed is a great accomplishment. So I'm here today to talk really about the first installment of how we implement that integrated water resources strategy. The governor has laid out in his governor's balanced budget a down payment on first steps to implement that strategy that includes several significant parts, and I'm going to run briefly through those. First and foremost, in terms of water supply, the package includes approximately $22 million in bond financing for the development of new multi-purpose water supply projects in the state of Oregon. This is Oregon really moving into a new role in water resources. It's a role that many of our neighboring states have taken on in terms of an active partner in water resources development with the federal government, with local partners, with private industry. And this is a down payment on Oregon beginning to do that same thing. Not just for irrigated agriculture, although that's important and there's a strong economic development component of this, but also for ecosystem function, for improving the condition of our fisheries. An aspect of that, which I think you know we have been working on for a number of years now, including under prior Governor Kulongoski, continuing on through this administration, is the Umatilla Project and efforts in the Umatilla Basin to look at new multi-purpose storage in that part of the state. That is a component of this, but this is a statewide program, looking not just at Umatilla, but also the Willamette Basin, Central Oregon, and far eastern Oregon as well. There has been an Oregon Solutions project convened by the governor for the Columbia Umatilla Basin that I co-convene along with County Commissioner Dennis Doherty from Umatilla County. And we've made great progress in that group. Phil has been there, as has Director Koba, helping that group come together on consensus recommendations for moving some specific projects forward in both the short term and the longer term for that part of the state. And that is somewhat the model that we're looking at for other parts of the state as well. So that's a major part of the governor's initiative in terms of water resources development, but there are some other parts that I want to walk you through briefly. In addition to the $22 million in bond financing for projects, there is also additional money for feasibility studies for these projects, both in the Umatilla Basin and elsewhere in the state.
Richard, just a quick question on that.
Yes.
$22 million for bond financing for projects, it doesn't really go very far. I mean, is that more towards the feasibility studies? Is that for capital? I'm trying to, I guess I expected like a zero or something on that number. But so is that more for the studies versus capital projects?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, the $22 million is actual project money for development of projects. The feasibility study money is an addition to that. And you're correct.
I'm assuming a cost share or something?
Yes. You know, large water projects today are costing anywhere from $500 million to more than $1 billion to do large-scale storage. But part of the message here is we need to do everything we can, not just those large-scale projects, but we really need to be doing a lot of small projects, and small projects that we can bring to fruition in a shorter period of time than some of these very large mega projects. So,
Well, I was going to mention for conservation, that's a good chunk of money. So
it is, and so that's part of the answer to your question, but the rest of the answer is the governor, as part of his 10-year budget, has also put together a projection of how he, and has recently issued an executive order for how he would propose to allocate future biennia allocations of bond financing for projects. And that identifies significant additional bond financing for water resources development beyond this biennium. So the $22 million figure is only for this biennium. All right. The other elements of the package that have been funded include some things that I think are of particular interest to this committee. So first of all, for Water Resources Department, a package for groundwater investigations, $250,000. Water use reporting, something I know that is of interest to the committee chair. Also, the agency request for additional funding for that was funded, along with a measurement, some funding for measurement cost share dollars. Also funding for restaffing, rebuilding some of the capacity in the Water Resources Department for hydrologists to do some of the technical work needed for these projects. And then, in addition, funding to update our water rights certificate system, which, again, is going to be important in the long term in terms of making our system work effectively. And then, last but not least, the governor has agreed with the Water Resources Commission that we should be looking at a new source of revenue for this part of state government in the form of a proposed water right management fee. Water Resources Department is in the middle of working, continuing to work with stakeholders on the details of that to put a package together that meets the needs of a stable funding for the department, but it is also workable for stakeholders. So the details of that are still being worked out. But the reality is, long term, this department has relied heavily on general fund dollars. And in order to provide a stable platform for both economic development purposes and resource conservation purposes, we need a more diversified funding base for this agency that's more in, akin to what the other most of the other natural resource agencies have. So in some form, we need to put that in place. And so we're looking forward to a good discussion about this issue in the upcoming legislative session, as well as with stakeholders leading up to session. So that's an overview. In addition, I've really focused primarily on the Water Resources Department pieces of this, but there are pieces for other agencies in this. That's why Director Koba is up here. There is also funding for the Department of Environmental Quality that's related to this package as well.
And we already mentioned the monitoring component,
yes,
which is multiple agency, cross-agency.
Which Chair Dingfelder, we'd be happy to come back and talk to you in January if you would like and go through the coordinated enterprise monitoring strategy that the agencies have for is a package and talk about that in more detail.
Mm-hmm. Great. Appreciate that. Mr. Ward?
Madam Chair, Phil Ward, for the record, with the Water Resources Department. Wish Brenda could be here to help kind of announce this completion of the Water Resources Strategy with you all. She's out ill today, but we really are pleased with the way the Integrated Water Resources Strategy for Oregon's come together. And it was an effort that you were intimately involved with initiating, Madam Chair, and we appreciate that. And it's an effort that the state as a whole took a great deal of ownership in. And as you know, our agency was given a small stipend to move this forward, but agencies like the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environmental Quality, ODFW, did not, and yet they participated as full partners in this effort. And I think we have a very credible and strongly supported product now that's come out as a result. So again, thank you for your vision in helping move this forward initially.
Well, and I should say, since Brenda is ill, you know, we need to thank Brenda, too, because she did a lot of the heavy lifting. But to all of you, I know you sat up there 3 years ago, probably with a different face on, like, you're really asking us to do this. And here we are 3 years later, and everyone's actually smiling, so that's a good sign. But I do appreciate, I know it was a big lift, and we didn't give you a lot to do that heavy lifting with, but I think everybody really rallied, and in the end, we have a product that all Oregonians can be proud of, and hopefully will be a roadmap in the future as we meet multiple goals for the state of Oregon, including economic development and conservation, fisheries, irrigated agriculture. So certainly we still have a lot of work to do, and hopefully we can make some progress on that in this upcoming session.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And we really do consider this a blueprint or a roadmap for the future in terms of Oregon water management. So Richard has covered, I think, the real guts of where we're headed in the next biennium. I just want to add a couple things, if I can, to his remarks. I would like to say that there are efforts already underway in terms of implementation of this strategy. One of the things that Brenda and her team did was try to identify things that we could do without new resources to move the tenets of this strategy forward. And they have been doing that in the last few months. One of the first things that they took on was updating Oregon's water permitting guide. And Oregon, a number of years ago, produced a guide for folks trying to work through the challenge of permitting different water-related projects in Oregon. And the intent was to put a guide together where people could go and find where all the folks they needed to contact were, how to contact them, and what they needed to do. That permitting guide had not been updated for a number of years. So we were able this last year, through the help of an intern from Oregon State University, to put an updated version of that permitting guide out. That's now out and available. Several of these type of activities, which were identified in the strategy as small things that we needed to do, but nonetheless as important things, are underway, and some are already, like that one, already at the completion point.
Director Ward, I'm assuming for folks listening on the Internet that guide is available online on your website.
Absolutely. That guide is available through links on our website. The Department of State Lands has historically been the host of that, and so that's available through their website as well. Fairly easy to find when you look for water-related permitting. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple other things quickly in relation to the current work plan. And again, Richard detailed very well the governor's investment for next biennium in the Integrated Water Resource Strategy. It really follows along two themes. One is data collection and coordination. One of the primary things that the stakeholder community agreed upon as we worked through this, the development of the strategy, was the fact that we needed to base our water-related decision-making on sound science in the years ahead. And to do that, we needed to have the data necessary for that kind of decision making. And so as Richard articulated, you see, again, considering the times, a modest but important investment back in some of this data gathering activity. Our groundwater program, as you know, Madam Chair, once invested heavily in characterizing the situation of our water resources underground. This governor's budget makes that a priority for the next strategy and begins a modest investment back in that activity where we have not had funds of a significant amount in recent years. Certainly in this strategy, there's significant investment in water monitoring, and you heard about that earlier from Director Koba, but ODA, DEQ, forestry, all have packages related to water monitoring, water quality monitoring, that are articulated as priorities in the strategy. The second general category is the one Richard spent most of his time on, water management and development. And certainly this, the fund related to water supply development is essentially a new activity for the state of Oregon. We got our toe in the water, so to speak, on this issue in 2008 when we initiated, with some help of state funding, the Umatilla Water Supply Development Project. Also in 2008, you will remember the feasibility grant fund, which this budget moves forward again, which concentrates not just on supply development, but on conservation and reuse work as well. The governor's budget and the strategy continue emphasis on that sense. But in terms of the supply development fund itself, I think you picked up exactly correctly that this is a small amount of money when it comes to water supply development. What this is, though, is the ability for the state to begin to partner with folks to move some of these things forward. And what we've seen in our sister state to the north, Washington, they had a larger initial investment, but again, used that to strategically partner with other folks to incent strategic water development activity moving forward. And that would be our intent in this first biennium particularly. We think there's some low-hanging fruit potentially that we can help get the ball rolling on. And again, we believe this is something from both a conservation and supply development standpoint that can be very effective for Oregon in the years ahead.
All right, thank you. Bacoba.
Good morning again.
You get the last
Chair,
word, maybe.
Members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. The department and the agriculture industry are clearly very interested in the implementation of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and there's a very plain reason why that is. Agriculture is clearly the largest user of out-of-stream appropriations of water in the state of Oregon. And we look at water as the lifeblood for agriculture in the state. And given what we're seeing and what Richard mentioned in terms of future water supplies, our commitment to the implementation of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy is very strong. And as has been discussed, this needs to be a long-term investment. Just a two-year investment is not going to get the job done. And so I think we all need to be committed to the long haul and realize that it's going to take many, many years to get Oregon where we think it needs to be. In addition, the challenges with water are truly statewide, and agriculture today faces water shortages, even in the Willamette Valley in the summertime, which is hard for some people to believe. Let me talk a little bit about the economics around agriculture's use of water. Right now, over 1.8 million acres of land is irrigated in the state of Oregon, and about half of Oregon's harvested cropland is irrigated. But the interesting statistic here is half of the irrigated land produces over 75% of the total value of harvested cropland in the state. So that really gets at the fact that when you add water to land, you produce a higher value crop, and that ripples through the economy in terms of the benefits to Oregon agriculture. It's also reflected in the land values when you have irrigation available. So average land values in Oregon for irrigated land are $4,200 per acre. When you compare that to the value for non-irrigated land of $1,900 per acre, you can see also the reflection and the importance of what happens when you add water to land. And we also have more jobs that are created with irrigated agriculture than with non-irrigated agriculture. So from an economic benefit, clearly, for agriculture and for the whole state of Oregon, where we can add water to land, we get a boost to our economy and jobs. But the industry has also demonstrated that it's not just looking for new water, but has a commitment to conserving existing water supplies, both for conservation, environmental benefits, as well as for reduced costs. I think you're familiar, others may not be, that Oregon's irrigators and irrigation districts are extensively moving to piping their water delivery systems and switching to more efficient uses of applying water to land.
Yeah, I have a quick question before I forget. And that has to do with that. A lot of my understanding is some of that money, that came for some of these piping and I guess covering projects, was from ARRA money. And so, is the dollars that you're talking about, $22 million, would some of that be available? And I know we have Jan Lee, who's head of the Oregon Conservation District, right behind us. But would some of that money be available as a conservation tool? I'm assuming there's other areas in the state where I'm assuming we haven't piped all of our irrigation dishes. Last I looked, there were still a few. Would that money also be available because of the potential savings for water users on that?
Madam Chair, I think the short answer to that is yes.
And I'm assuming you're doing a needs, that's part of the needs assessment. Okay. Thank you.
So clearly a commitment there in terms of irrigators and irrigation districts. There's actually data that's collected by the census, which also can document savings in terms of focus on conservation and reduced energy costs. In coming out of the 2007 Ag Census, nearly 5,000 of Oregon's irrigated farms, which represented over 1 million acres, reported making both energy and water conservation improvements in the previous 5 years. Out of those farms, over 2,000 reported reduced energy costs, and over 3,000 reported reduced water applied. So Oregon agriculture continues to be committed to conservation efforts, improving irrigation, really to, you know, this precious resource that we have, making it go as far as we possibly can. In the governor's recommended budget, our agency has funded one position that would be a water quantity expert to really move forward in terms of the implementation of the integrated water resources strategy. We think it's only appropriate, given the use that agriculture has in terms of Oregon's out-of-stream water appropriations, and would be focused on implementation of the strategy as well as continuing pushing forward efforts around conservation and energy reduction. So we're hoping that we get legislative support for our little piece of the funding for the integrated water resources strategy. Thank you.
Great. All right. Well, any questions, Senator? All right. I think that's it for today. I'm sure we'll be hearing more during the upcoming session and certainly as we discuss the budgets as well. And thank you all for being here today and providing an update. I look forward to working with you, and have a good holiday.
Thank you, Madam
Thank you.
Chair.
Thank you. We have our last item. Actually, we're going to take a quick break and do a work session, and then we will hear our last item on forestry today. But since we seem to have some missing in action members, we've found one that can come sit in with us, the Senate President. And here. With that, we're going to take a quick we're going to open up a work session just for the purpose of committee bill introduction. Mm-hmm. And folks, to know, this is part of the process. In order to have a discussion on bills, we need to have them introduced into the committee. This does not mean that there is any approval of any of the topic areas. It's just purely for introduction purposes. And with that, I will open up a work session for the Senate Environment Committee. And
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Hess, I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 950, dated December 10th, 2012. LC 1048, dated October 3rd, 2012. LC 1190, dated October 8th, 2012. LC 2087, dated October 12th, 2012. LC 2125, dated November 21st, 2012. LC 2320, dated November 14th, 2012.
Okay, Senator Hass moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, as I mentioned, for discussion purposes. LC 950, dated December 10th, 2012. LC 1048, dated October 3rd, 2012. LC 1190, dated October 8th, 2012. LC 2087, dated October 12th, 2012, LC 2025, dated November 21st, 2012, LC 2320, dated November 14th, 2012. Is there any discussion from any of the members? No. Nope. Any objections? All right. Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills, and we will close the work session on committee bill introduction. Thank you. Sure you don't want to stay for the forestry discussion? It's really fascinating.
I'm going to another committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President. Okay, last but not least, we will now hear on forestry issues. I've asked the Department of Forestry to come, and of course, again, this is for informational purposes. We will have more discussions during the session. We're going to hear now on forest management issues and fire protection funding, and I've asked the state forester to come forward. I know he has some sidekicks with him to help him out. We're going to hear a little bit more about progress that's being made on a couple issues, and As you can imagine, the chair did her homework, and I have some questions for you as well.
Excellent.
I was reading the budget last night. I know it sounds crazy, but okay. Welcome.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you much. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I'm the Oregon State Forester, the Director of the Department of Forestry.
Doug, can you pull the mic just a little bit closer, because
sure.
Very good. I have to teach you to carry. Okay. My mother was an opera singer, so I'll give you some lessons.
For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm the Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. Joining me here is Mike Bordelon. Mike is the Chief of our State Forest Division. We're going to start with some conversation about state forests here, and then we're also going to be shifting after that to talk a little bit about the Wildfire Protection Act and about fire funding in Oregon. I know that... I guess it was September we came before you to talk about private forests and about our share of the water quality discussion. We're going to be focusing on our other two businesses here today. So we'll start off with state forests, and I want to add just a little bit of context before I ask Mike to walk us through a couple of key pieces. In Oregon, state forests represent about 3% of our total forest land base. You know, we've got about 821,000 acres of state forest land. So we're not by any means the major landowner. A significant chunk of state forest ownership exists in northwest Oregon and the Tillamook and Clatsop state forests. Recently acquired Gilchrist State Forest in central Oregon, as well as the Sun Pass State Forest and the Elliott State Forest down near Coos Bay. On these lands, on these Board of Forestry-owned lands, we managed to produce, to provide what we call greatest permanent value, which is social, economic, and environmental values. We harvest timber. We provide recreation opportunities. We provide habitat. And it's that mix of different benefits and values that we describe as greatest permanent value. So it's a little bit about our business. And it was just over a year ago when the governor came before the Board of Forestry and offered us some encouragement and some direction for us to pursue several initiatives on state forests. And I want to just recap those because they framed our work for this last year. First, refine our performance measures for state forest management. Essentially, our performance measures are essentially the yardsticks by which we measure success. We've done that over this last year. Second, the governor encouraged us to consider alternative approaches to managing state forest land, alternative ways to deliver greatest permanent value, specifically how a land allocation approach, which would look at conservation emphasis and wood emphasis in different areas, how that might help better address our performance measures and also provide a better degree of certainty for all interests. The third element was to establish a framework for recognizing conservation values on state forests and to manage these areas using a scientific basis as an expression of the board's conservation values in action. And Mike will be talking specifically about this piece here in just a moment. Fourth, and very importantly, was to be able to do all of these things in a viable financial business model. And you'll recall that state forests are completely self-funding. There are no general fund dollars involved in the management of state forests, very limited outside funding support. So in order to be able to keep a viable business, we need to be able to generate the revenue to be able to deliver on all of these expectations. And right now the board and the department have been engaged in a conversation looking at that business models and looking at the financial viability of the program. We'll touch a little bit on that here in a moment. So these four items that were key in the governor's comments to us in November of last year really have shaped our work on these topics this year. I think it's been a busy and I'd say a successful year as we've pursued these. And Mike's going to give us a kind of a walk through the conservation area framework as well as our work on alternative management strategies. So we'll turn it over to Mike Bordelon.
Great. You got the. I was joking. How many committee staff does it take to get our our laptop working? But
going.
I see you,
right.
We've got it. Thank
Looks
you.
Looks like
Sue.
It's working great. Yeah.
Now we're trying to get the air conditioning turned off.
Okay.
Hold up here. I'm going to get my.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Bordelon. I'm the State Forest Division Chief. It's a pleasure to be able to address a couple of issues this morning at your request. As Doug said, those issues are conservation areas on state forest and also talk a little bit about alternative management strategies. So just a little bit of background and history on the conservation areas issue or topic. Our current Northwest Forest Management Plan, which is the plan that covers about 700,000 acres in the northwest part of the state, it's the dominant management plan. That management plan makes significant contributions to conservation values, but we don't use that terminology of conservation areas. When we were developing that plan in the late 1990s, there were various terminologies and definitions of reserve areas and conservation areas, etc. And in the end, we chose to use a somewhat more neutral term of stewardship areas, neutral in some respects and not as well understood in other respects. So as we proceeded forward here in the last couple of years in discussions with the Board of Forestry and some legislative discussions, a couple of key concepts keep coming up, and that is, one, how can we increase the visibility or the public understanding about the current efforts we have in terms of conservation on state forest lands, which from my perspective, we have a pretty significant contribution. And then secondly, sort of exploring some concepts around certainty or permanence. When you have these areas, what's that durability component? How long are they there on the landscape, et cetera? So from that perspective, those are visibility and the durability are the two issues we're working on with the Board of Forestry. We've also sort of described this work in terms of two phases. Tier one is thinking about conservation areas as a strategy in our current forest management plans. And secondly, sort of a broader perspective of conservation areas as a component of alternative management approaches, sort of following the governor's recommendation to look at a zoned approach or a land allocation approach. We're currently working on tier one of this. Definitions are important, and as we sort of proceed forward, we're gaining some acceptance with stakeholders and the board around sort of our definition of conservation areas on state forest, and really two components. One, these are lands that are identified through our planning efforts or they're a legal requirement where we have specific conservation values that need to be maintained, enhanced, or restored, and the forest management activities that are pursued there are limited to those that are compatible with achieving those conservation goals. So these are, in essence, not no management reserve areas on state forests. These are areas where we have specific conservation objectives. Any management activity need to be aligned with those objectives. And there's been general agreement among folks in terms of that, the appropriateness of that definition. We have a classification system, which is really a mapping system. And that mapping system is called the Forest Land Management Classification System. This is our current approach. And just a little bit of explanation about what it is. There are three sort of categories of zoning or mapping within this current approach. The first is general stewardship, and that is basically most of our state forest landscape, which is actively managed using integrated resource management strategies. In some areas, we have what we call focused stewardship designation, and an example would be a scenic corridor along Highway 6 or 26. In those areas, we modify some of our timber harvest prescriptions in those areas. Those areas are labeled focused stewardship. And sort of the highest level of protection is called special stewardship. And these lands are committed to a specific use or value, and any management activities need to be compatible or aligned with that value. So special stewardship really is also known as basically conservation. The component of this is conservation areas. So as we took this classification system to the Board of Forestry, what we recommended and what the board directed us to pursue was to look at amending our current classification system and retain general stewardship and focused stewardship on the landscape. But when we got to special, what we're calling special stewardship, replace that with two new classifications. One would be labeled high-value conservation areas, and these are areas where we have threatened and endangered species. The inner zones of riparian areas are another example, anchor wildlife habitats. Really, the focus here for these high-value conservation areas are wildlife, plants, and aquatic riparian. The other category within special stewardship are areas like transmission lines, administrative sites, steep slopes, where there's basically harvesting is going to be prohibited under the Forest Practices Act. These are would be termed special use areas. So at this point in time, we're proceeding through an administrative rule amendment process that would make these type of changes and allow us within our current forest management plan to appropriately label some of these areas that we have conservation areas.
And I'm assuming you already have those all mapped out through your GIS system and you know where all those areas are. So is it going to entail additional field work, or do you already have those areas identified through those categories that you enumerated?
Senator Dingfelter, we have special stewardship areas mapped out, and our task ahead of us will be to make the split between what is conservation and what is special use.
And generally, what percentage falls into that category of special stewardship?
There's about 20 to 22 in the northwest part of the state. That's about 20 to 22% of the landscape falls into that category of, at this point in time, special stewardship.
I was going to say, as a follow-up, I'd be interested to see those maps.
Yeah,
once
okay.
You
be glad to do that.
Get those overlay zones.
From my perspective, and I think the agency's perspective, there are some potential benefits of moving in this direction of making this administrative rule amendment. I think it helps us create a commonly accepted and more easily understood definition of conservation areas. Secondly, it will hopefully increase the awareness, sort of the public understanding of our current conservation efforts on state forests. And third, as we think about alternative management strategies, the change in this classification system will allow us to be positioned to take advantage of that when we get to the alternative management approach. So from the administrative rule process standpoint, we're going to be conducting public hearings in March and February, one in Hillsboro, one in Cannon Beach. Hope to finish the rulemaking process in April, be back to the Board of Forestry in June of 13.
And what were those dates again? I'm sorry.
Excuse me. February and March, I don't have the specific dates, Senator Dingfelter, Hillsboro and Cannon Beach, two public hearings.
Okay.
And then we would be applying this administrative rule to our current forest management plan beginning in 2013 and 14. And to make this sort of operationally efficient, we would apply it sort of as a normal part of our business, of our annual operational planning. This would be one component of that. And then this then ties into the second tier of our work, which is considering conservation areas when we're evaluating alternative management plans. So that's the other step. So I think I'll stop there just for a second and see if there are any questions from the committee before I move on to alternative management strategies.
I think I've been asking my questions as I've gone along, and then I look to see you've got the dates right. I wasn't going as fast as your slides, so I was writing copious notes. You could go ahead and proceed.
The information I'm sharing here is what we shared with the Board of Forestry in July of this year. When we talked to them about alternative management strategies, Doug spoke a little bit about the why. Why is it we're looking to potentially change our current forest management plan? And from my perspective, three reasons. One, the information and the recommendations from the governor about looking at another approach and acknowledging our financial challenges. The current Northwest Forest Management Plan, which is the dominant management plan for our Board of Forestry lands, is clearly underperforming expectations. This plan was approved in 2001, and upon approval, the agency, through some modeling efforts, estimated that we would be achieving somewhere around 90% of what could be achieved under a wood emphasis approach. The reality is we were achieving something like 60 to 70% of that level. From a revenue perspective, this particular plan has underachieved expectations of both the agency and the board.
So I have a question on that, if I may. And I know I've asked this before, but in this context, I know things have changed. That was a decade ago. So the plan that was approved in 2011, it's 2011, mm-hmm. correct?
2010.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Did you look at alternative certification scenarios? So managing forests in a different way as far as capitalizing on changing markets?
Mm-hmm. We have looked at certification processes in terms of the sort of two potential values. One is to create better public understanding and acceptance of management approach, and I think there's some value there. We've also looked at certification from the standpoint of market share and whether it adds economic value specifically. And on that latter, I would say, is a very marginal, if any, economic gain associated with certification. At least that's what our sort of analysis shows at this point in time. That was one of the elements we looked at. The Senator Dingfelter, you're correct. We had, the plan was revised. It was a 2001 plan. It was revised in 2010.
Right.
And at that time, we really adjusted our current force management plan. We didn't look broadly at sort of significantly different approaches. The approach that we're thinking about here really is to look a little more broadly beyond the bounds of our integrated resource management approach, our structure-based management approach.
And Madam Chair, I think that will include a look at the certification systems that are out there. I've had a chance to visit with a number of my colleagues, other Western state foresters and state foresters in the Midwest, and there are states that, you know, that do dual certification. That's something that we will look at. This idea of the alternative management strategies really is a broader look that would be in line with the kind of energy that we would expect associated with, like, the 2001 planning effort that we went through. This is kind of a more fundamental look at how we're managing these lands. And I think a look at certification is appropriate as we consider that.
And sort of a third factor here in terms of sort of why we're looking at alternative management plans, these things all sort of line up together here, is just the current financial situation for the State Forest Division. We're operating with a pretty diminished fund. We have less than 6 months operating reserve in that fund at this point in time. This management plan and the revenue generated through it is extremely important, so that's another factor involved here. Our initial look here at some possible management scenarios include taking a look at our, of course, as we model and analyze these things, we'll look at our current forest management plan as one sideboard. We'll look at a wood emphasis approach that uses Forest Practices Act also as a sideboard in this discussion with the board. Doug mentioned the zoned or land allocation approach that's been recommended by the governor. There's many variations of that zoned approach that we could potentially look at. We've discussed an approach that would really simply be setting a longer, I say longer rotation age, something like 80 to 100 years on this landscape as sort of the central driving factor. That's been looked at before as a potential excellent management approach. And then last, we have differences among our districts in the way that our lands are configured. So in Northwest Oregon, we have a 500,000-acre block of contiguous ownership. And then in other places, we got scattered ownership mixed in with private industry or with federal lands. The management plans potentially need to be different between those different areas. So that's the other component that we're taking a look at here as we explore alternative approaches. The process here is fairly straightforward in terms of moving forward with developing alternative management plans. Albeit a significant effort, develop a project team and plan, refine these strategies that I talked about. We'll have a stakeholder involvement component to this. We'll be looking to analyze those strategies and bring the analysis and the policy choices back to the Board of Forestry. When we shared this information with the board in July, we shared with them this draft timeline of starting coming back to the board in June 13 with some refined proposed strategies, complete the modeling within the next year. This is about a three-year process to walk through this. In comparison, when we put together our original 2001 Forest Management Plan, we went through about a seven-year process to get to that point. So we see this as somewhat expedited. I think there are some concerns by some board members, given our financial situation, that perhaps we need to speed this process up a little bit.
Which we share.
Do you have any questions? I have one regarding your, if this has to do with the injunction right now to stop timber sales, and obviously, I think it's on the Elliott. Obviously, that will certainly affect how much revenue that you're looking at. So can you talk a little bit about, I know that at one point there was a multi-species HCP discussions. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, one of the other things obviously you're concerned about is the legal costs of the state. So mm-hmm. have you been looking at efforts to restart that negotiation process for the multi-species HCP?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about the original work on the Elliott multi-species HCP. That work was done here started several years back. The Elliott has had, starting in 1995, we ended up with a habitat conservation plan for northern spotted owls and a six-year plan, habitat conservation plan for marbled murrelets, a very short duration. As we proceeded forward, at some point in time, we realized there's an opportunity to have a multiple species HCP that would include murrelets again and other species. We spent 10 years and several million dollars working through the multi-species HCP approach, and in the end, we could not come to agreement, basically, with NOAA, NIMFS on aquatic riparian strategies. State Land Board and Board of Forestry said, okay, we can't reach agreement. We're going to need to take another approach, so we proceeded and received approval last year for a Elliott Forest Management Plan that did not include a habitat conservation plan. So we, as you said, Madam Chair, we are involved in some litigation at this point in time that basically is associated with our take avoidance policies on murrelets, both on the Elliott and on our Northwest Forest lands. We're exploring a range of options here in terms of addressing that litigation.
So that is an option that's still on the
table?
That's
one of the things that's being discussed as part of what we're discussing.
Well, I guess you'll keep us posted on that, but I would say that certainly looking at alternatives, given the potential legal costs, may be a good thing. Mm-hmm. That's the only question I had on that. If you want to move on to the Wildfire Protection Act,
All right.
I've got some questions
Thanks,
based
Mike.
On reviewing the budget. But
okay, we'll transition to fire now. And a little first, a little context. Travis Medema will join me up here. Travis is a project leader on in our fire protection division. Has been working on the Wildfire Protection Act. And while he sets up, maybe just a little context about the 2012 fire season. We'll talk about total number of fires. We had about 70% of our 10-year average of fires this last year. We had about 676 fires that burned about 18,000 acres, and that's about 83% of our 10-year average. The large fire costs associated with that, again, this is an under the average fire season on state protected lands. We protect about 16 million acres of forest land from Oregon. In Oregon, we are Oregon's largest fire department. The large fire costs ran to about $5.4 million, and that's in addition to the 40 plus million dollar costs that are kind of our baseline, the fire department, what it takes to run the fire department every year. So
Doug, can I get a copy of all of those? I don't, unless
yes.
it's in this handout.
Yeah. We'll send you information that looks at our fire costs for this last year. We were for the e-board yesterday, and that's all very well documented.
I just want one spot that has all that. The yep. other is, this is just focusing on state forests, right?
Not on state forests, but on state protection.
State
so
protection.
16 million acres, state, right. private, and Bureau of Land Management lands in Western Oregon.
I was going to ask you,
but
only not in Eastern Oregon, because BLM,
Eastern
that's
Oregon.
Where we lost.
That's correct.
Like how many hundreds of thousands of acres?
Right. It was over a million, and those are on lands. Mm-hmm. Many of those lands were on lands that are not protected. They currently do not have, there's no jurisdiction to protect them. And we've actually been working with many of those rangeland owners to form essentially what are volunteer fire departments that fall under the authority of the Board of Forestry called Rangeland Fire Protection Associations. Right now we have 12 or 13 of those in Oregon, and the landowners there are organizing. We provide federal excess property to them. We provide a level of training for them as well, but they're essentially a volunteer fire department, and as a result of the fires that we saw in Southeast Oregon this year, folks have decided that they want to get together and get working together, neighbors helping neighbors to fight those fires. That's outside of our actual jurisdiction where we do operations.
So, but I do have a question, because this does affect costs. How are those jurisdictions set in statute, or are they set through rule? Are they self-imposed? So, in other words, if folks in Eastern Oregon decided the benefits to joining it. Obviously, there are going to be costs as well,
right,
but there's going to be added benefits, greater protection levels, mm-hmm, will also help spread the costs that we have currently have. How does that happen?
Right. Well, on rangeland protection associations, those are landowner funded. I mean, they exist. The statutory authority is within the Board of Forestry's authority, mm-hmm, but they essentially, you know, we provide very minimal level of assistance to them, and they're out there fighting fire themselves with used equipment and with some training and some coordination that we try to provide some liaison with the BLM and with other organizations. But they're basically on the hook themselves for the costs associated with fighting those fires. And they find that coming together, you know, there's a small economy of scale that they can work together and help each other out in the way that a volunteer fire department would. Now, that's a different model than our fire protection districts, where landowners have, you know, where they actually have organized. There's a statutory authority, and they're kind of part of our budget, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not really referring to the rangeland protection associations in the context of the Wildfire Protection Act.
I guess my question, and I don't want to get too much off track, but is there any way to merge them and provide, you know, economies of scale, and also obviously that's a big chunk of the state that is at risk, so it's just a...
Right. Well, we look at the formation of rangeland protection associations as the first step in helping to control those costs. You know, and those costs can be significant. And, you know, you have to look at kind of the resource value that's at play there. And right now within our jurisdiction of timberlands and grazing lands, that does not include those areas. But becoming a rangeland protection association does help them to begin to have that economy of scale.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Great.
Right.
All right. I'll let you keep going.
Right. So just a little context about fire season. So I guess the key point there was it was below normal on state protected lands, and we had about $5.5 million of additional large fire costs. So large fire costs are something that we deal with on a regular basis. Fires are becoming more complex and more costly in recent years due to the increasing buildups of forest fuels as a result of drier, longer, hotter summers and conditions, and that puts our forests in jeopardy, and it also puts public finance in jeopardy in terms of how we pay for fires. For the last several biennial cycles, the board and the department, we've been working with landowners and others to try to come up with some ideas to kind of bend the cost curve on fires. And we've packaged them together into what we call the Wildfire Protection Act. We're trying to leverage private funds up front to bolster our strong initial attack response to basically keep fires small. So a package of the concepts are in the governor's recommended budget, and they're also in a rework of existing statute that defines the different funding mechanisms that we call the Wildfire Protection Act. And Travis Medema has been a project leader working with us on this, and he's ready to kind of walk us through the why and the what of the Wildfire Protection Act.
Thank you, Travis. Mm-hmm.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Senator Hass, it's a pleasure to be here with you and have a conversation about the Wildfire Protection Act. For the record, my name is Travis Medema. I work for the Oregon Department of Forestry here in Salem. So to provide some broader policy context around the Wildfire Protection Act and our fire protection program, at the highest level, it's really tucked underneath the Board of Forestry and the Forestry Program for Oregon, and it's all about maintaining working green forests and being able to protect those forests so landowners can make investments into the future, and then also all the benefits that forests provide to all Oregonians. With under that, the department's got some pretty clear missions. Number one, obviously, is protect Oregon's valuable forest land and rangeland. We also protect communities from wildfire. We have a role in the urban interface and partner with local fire departments and help protect communities all across the state. We do that through a time-tested 100-year-old strategy, which is a safe and aggressive initial attack. We go after fires at the smallest possible size. And what that does is, over time, reduce cost and then also reduce resource loss and damages, and that's something we've been involved with for the last 101 years, so and works very well. To get at some of these challenges that have existed in the fire protection system, in November of 2011, the board chartered work group through the department to bring together some stakeholders and key constituents and develop a fire protection funding committee. This funding committee met four times. Their goal was to address these challenges, and we'll get to those in a minute. And ultimately what that group came up with is what we now know as the Wildfire Protection Act, and it really gets at some of these larger challenges. So what were some of the challenges that the board asked the department and the work group to take a look at? First is protecting and limiting risk to Oregonians, forest, rangeland, and other values. State Forester Decker said the department protects 16 million acres of forest land, and annually, as we know, from June to October, these lands are at risk from wildfire. We've seen trends in wildfire across the West increasing, and really one of the key questions was how can we be more effective? And when I say more effective is, are there things we can be doing to reduce the number of large fires? Because large fires cost a whole bunch of money. So could we be more effective there? The second component was, as we know, these large fires can run from millions to tens of millions of dollars, as we've seen. Some states have had $100 million fire seasons in the last couple years. Texas is an example of that. And we know that that's both a financial loss, but then also the resource loss is immense. We know that when a wildfire occurs, it's hard to calculate the values that are lost from our natural resources, but we know there are significant impacts, whether it's water impacts, whether it's air impacts, or any other environmental impacts that occur. And so if we can reduce those number of large fires, we're reducing those negative impacts to Oregonians. The third challenge that the board asked the work group to address in the wildfire protection gets at is this concept of east side affordability. Currently, the east side lands are the lowest productivity lands. Those are our four protection districts on the east side of the state. These districts pay the highest cost of fire protection. They also receive the most starts from lightning, which are problematic for us, and they also have the least milling infrastructure. So as you put those pieces together, east side forestry is really a challenge. And so the concept helps address pieces of those issues. And then the last is equity in fire cost. Currently, equity exists in much of the system. However, over time, because of how large fires are paid for, inequity has occurred, and so the concept really strives to get at equity. I like diagrams because fire protection funding can be very complex at times, and so I wanted to put this diagram up just to talk through what the three key levels are in fire protection in the state of Oregon. The first level you'll see at the bottom, that's the base level of fire protection. This to me is really the backbone and our real business model. These are the young men and women that are out there on the engines fighting fires, the bulldozers, the helicopters. These are all accomplished through 12 forest protection districts located across the state, and their charge is to really prevent, detect, and suppress fires at the smallest possible size. This represents annually about $41 million in cost in this base level of protection. And as folks have also heard, this is where the 50-50 relationship occurs between private landowners and the state's general fund at this base level. The next level of defense is a severity program. And this severity program came out of some fire program work done in 2004 and has really been a significant benefit to the department. And the severity program is fully funded by general fund. It's out of a special purpose appropriation. And so what we do with those funds is we contract two heavy air tankers. So when you see the air tankers flying with the retardant coming out, two of those are contracted with these dollars, one in Redmond, one in Medford. And then we also contract Type 2 helicopters and strategically place those around the state. The key with severity resources are that they're fast mobilizing, they can get to fires quickly, and they can stop them at the smallest possible size. These are statewide resources and can go anywhere in the forest protection districts. One of the challenges is that's a pretty limited amount of funding if you're talking heavy air tankers and helicopters. And so as we looked at, you know, what can we do to reduce large fires, this was one key area and key concept that I'll show you next in the following diagram. The last real component of fire funding in the state of Oregon is if you're not successful at initial attack and severity hasn't stopped the fire and you unfortunately have a large fire, how does that large fire get paid for? And currently the system is designed where a landowner fund, and sorry for the acronym, but it's the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, pays the first $9.5 million of large fire cost, and then the general fund is responsible for the next $15.5 million. And we often refer to this as the deductible. There's $25 million there that is allocated and set aside for large fire cost. If we were to have a catastrophic year and exceed that, we then annually purchase an insurance premium, and that insurance premium is a $25 million premium through Lloyd's of London. And so this represents $50 million in identified funding that's there for large fire costs. So three levels, the base, severity, and how large fires are paid for. So knowing that there were some challenges within the system and challenges at each one of these levels, the work group really had to kind of roll up their sleeves and dig in and figure out, you know, what kind of recommendations could we make across these three levels to solve these challenges and issues that the board had identified. So the first concept that's part of the Wildfire Protection Act, Legislative Concept 575, really gets at this east side affordability issue and how to reduce the private landowner's cost on the east side. And there's a chart there. That chart shows productivity in yellow, and that's from the west side of the state moving east. The red line shows the cost or the per acre assessment cost for fire protection. And you'll see a departure between productivity and the cost of fire protection. That's really the highlighted issue that we're talking about with east side affordability and lower productivity lands. So the concept uses $1 million, and you'll see it highlighted there in yellow with an arrow going down to the base level. That'll be put into the four east side fire protection districts and lower the private landowner's cost for fire protection in those districts. Once again, they have the highest cost of fire protection and the lowest productivity lands. As I said earlier, we know fire season severity across the West and in Oregon has increased. This is a chart that shows days when we're at a high likelihood or have a high risk of large fires, and it looks at the last 20 years. The recent 10 years, we've seen a significant increase in risk of large fire, and we use this and track a number to say once we've reached this threshold, we've done a lot of statistical analysis to say once this threshold is reached, we've got a correlation strongly with large fires. Those days that we've been at risk for large fires have more than doubled in the last 10 years.
So what do you think the cause of that is?
I think it's a whole bunch of different factors. I think fuels, I think snow, I think climate. I think there's a whole bunch of different factors that have played into it.
And is that on what land again, where you've seen that increase?
Yeah, is that across state? All your lands, or is that, all the fire protection lands, or you're talking about specifically in eastern?
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, great question. This is a specific chart from the John Day area. We've seen this same trend occur on the east side and also on some of the west side districts. Northwest hasn't had this strong of a correlation, but the real heavy fire districts, Southern Oregon, Douglas, we've seen the same correlation, this overall increase in days at risk.
Is there any direct correlation with juniper? Or it's, I mean, you said it's a combination of fuels and such, but I'm curious because certainly juniper has had a big impact on our ecosystem.
It's predominantly a weather-driven, right. Madam Chair, predominantly weather-driven piece. Mm-hmm. And when I say fuels, I'm saying that under the context of we've seen fuels increase across the landscape, and that adds to severities of fire seasons. And so what the concept does to address this increased risk and challenge is it uses and leverages an additional $3 million of landowner money, once again, out of this Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and you'll see it there, $3 million in statewide severity. And so it's taking these landowner dollars that have historically paid for, only been able to pay for large fire costs, and making this upfront investment, saying, hey, if we can invest some more dollars in severity, we can reduce the number of large fires and damages to resources. So the landowners have said they're interested in making this upfront investment in severity. In totality, Madam Chair, what that does is it increases the severity program from what it is in the current system, which is just over $2 million, to up to $5 million, which would significantly put more funding into the system to allow us to procure and bring on resources that we could strategically place in front of lightning events and when we know we're going to have challenges and we reach these key thresholds. The third part of the concept moves towards sharing of large fire costs differently. In the current model of how fire is funded, that picture showed a layer fashion where the landowners had paid for fire protection large fire protection costs up to $9.5 million, and general fund paid $15.5 million. This moves through a phased-in approach over three biennia to a dollar-for-dollar sharing of large fire costs, so a vertical split of large fire costs instead of one party pays first and then the other party. And I'll explain the scheduling of that three biennia implementation here in a minute. The chart up there on the top right-hand corner shows some of that inequity over time and who's paid for fire costs in the state of Oregon between landowners and the general fund. And once again, because of this layered fashion where landowners through the fund have paid first, we've averaged about $8 million in fire costs. If they're responsible for the first $9.5 million, they've covered all the cost of large fire suppression. So that's led to an inequity in who's paid for large fire suppression costs.
I was going to say inequity. I mean, your term of inequity is implying that the state should pick up more. I'm just trying to figure out what the use of that term is in this context.
Madam Chair, and when I say inequity, just I should say equity in who's paying for large fire cost or equal sharing of large fire cost.
Maybe some regional context about that, other states?
Sure. Go ahead, or would you like
me
to? State Forester Decker, Madam Chair, has asked me to talk a little bit about what other states and how they pay for large fire costs. Most of the other states in the West, all large fire costs come from general fund. They make an appropriation request. They have a budget that's very minuscule. Montana's an example. They had a $60 million fire season. That's a Montana DNRC ask to the state legislature to have that $60 million covered in large fire costs. Oregon's very unique in that landowners through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund pay a portion of large fire costs and pay the first portion of that fire cost. So what does it take or what's needed for the Wildfire Protection Act? Again, landowners are allocating up to $3 million from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund for statewide severity. This will increase the exposure of landowners to $13.5 million, once again $10 million for large fire cost, and $3 million for paying for statewide severity, and these are annual numbers. It requires an additional $800,000 of general fund. And that'll be used as a portion along with a small amount in the special purpose appropriation currently to provide that east side rate relief for affordability for east side landowners. And then it phases in large fire cost over time. The large fire cost phased in implementation schedule that's proposed in legislative concept 575 is a three biennium approach. In biennium 13-15, the upcoming one, it shares $1 million or $2 million, $1 million by each party, the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund and the General Fund each fiscal year. In 15-17, it moves that amount to $5 million and $5 million shared dollar for dollar or $10 million in total. And then in 17 and beyond, it goes to a straight $10 and $10 million shared $20 million total. So an $8 million fire season in 2017 would cost the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund $4 million and State General Fund $4 million. A key piece in this is that two thoughts on it. Number one is that it does reduce the overall exposure of the State General Fund. As it currently is structured right now, the State General Fund is responsible for $15 million annually in large fire costs. This reduces it to 10. So there would be $10 million only that would be available from State General Fund for large fire cost. The second piece to that, though, is that the likelihood that the General Fund would be paying for large fire cost would increase because of that dollar-for-dollar sharing as you split that deductible. So what would be the results, or what are the anticipated results from the Wildfire Protection Act? We believe that all Oregonians would benefit for having a greater level of fire protection on our forest, reducing those negative impacts of wildfire and cost. We believe that investments up front make long-term savings. It addresses this east side affordability issue and maintaining working forests on the east side, and then creates equity or greater sharing in large fire cost and reduces the overall general fund exposure, however, increases the likelihood of the general fund having costs for large fire. Last slide, the next steps. This is a department and board's priority policy package as we look to 13-15. It was fully approved in the governor's balanced budget just recently. We've got a group of stakeholders that are working together on the Wildfire Protection Act, and then we're really looking forward to the legislative session in 13-15 to have more conversations about the Wildfire Protection Act and its benefit. And with that, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, it's been a pleasure, and I'd be more than glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I very much appreciate that. I guess I've been on the Revenue Committee for 12 years, and I don't think there's any tax policy that we have is more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you're right.
And I've seen these presentations before, and it just feels like it's so complex and so many moving hydraulics to pay for this. And I'm not offering up a simpler solution, but seems like there ought to be one.
Well, I have a suggestion, and I'm going to ask to follow up on the good senator's comments, because it is a complicated system. I've been observing it for 12 years, moving parts. So one of the things, two follow-up items I have, and I was reading through the budget last night and thinking about this, I think it would be helpful for if you could provide either a spreadsheet or a table, however you want to do it, sort of like the graph that you showed with the projections of the other funds and general funds over time. I think it would be helpful to have a table that shows, I'm just reading through my notes, sort of the side-by-side costs under the present system versus what's being proposed. And actually, I think it would be good to show it historically about how much more general fund we're going to have to use versus money coming from the private landowners. And the reason I ask that is, we talk about the public benefits, certainly the fact that, we don't want to have catastrophic fires that are going to cost the state more in the long term. But I think it's important. I mean, our job is to spend taxpayer dollars wisely, as it is your job, too. But we have the chair of the Education Committee sitting right next to me that has, we've seen diminishing classroom teacher resources and expanding classrooms over the past decade that I've been here, and for continual trend, it seems like hopefully we'll be able to reverse that. But the reality, as you know, gentlemen, we have very limited general fund dollars, and I guess our job is to make sure that we're spending those in the most effective and efficient manner. And when we're looking at a greater subsidy for private landowners, that with the payback being greater protection for the state forests and all of our forests as a whole, I still think it's really important that we need to do a careful cost-benefit analysis of that. And so I think it would be helpful for us to, and this may get to Senator Haas's question about seeing that side-by-side comparison. Mm-hmm. We're making a pretty significant shift. I know it's moved back and forth, and would like to see that analysis. I think that would be helpful. I'm sure they'll be doing that for the Ways and Means Committee as well. And then the other one, you have not brought this up, but I've heard this in the past, is, there's a great pressure for, there's development pressure on these lands, and so we need to make sure that we're, keeping them in forest production, which, I absolutely support, but that's also part of the justification that I've heard behind some of these subsidies. We don't want to say we're not going to help you pay the costs. Landowners default and say we can't afford it. We're going to transition those, sell those out. And part of it is that we've been hearing about the threat of declining forest land. And so I don't know if you guys have been able to quantify that, or if you have particular areas of the state on the urban. The fringe areas, because I do know that's where we're talking about sometimes the greatest risks. So I think that information would be helpful as well. I mean, in essence, how do we justify the fact that we're going to be spending more general fund on this program? That's my understanding. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I think that to the fragmentation question, we've actually done some very good work that looks back at what's been the trend line for the fragmentation of forest land and what are the complications associated with that. And we can definitely share that with you. I think from my perspective and from the board's perspective, the upfront investment of a modest amount of finance to be able to kind of in the idea of protecting the larger finance. You know, it's kind of a pay me now or pay me later type of, and frankly, we would rather put a small amount up front in terms of increasing our ability to initial attack fires as opposed to a larger amount to pay for large fire costs. That's the essential philosophy, and I think we can organize around that, this notion of showing historic, current, and proposed, and show you what that looks like, as well as look at what some of the trends are in terms of fragmentation and development. Obviously, with the market down and with our land use planning system in place, those numbers are modest compared to other states, but we can definitely show that. Share that with you.
And I think a big part of that is demonstrating what is the public benefit, because that's what it's all about. I mean, you know, again, limited resources. We are, you know, competing for a shrinking or stable amount of pie. So how do we justify the fact that we are going to, because that money is going to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. It may come from the education budget, you know, it's got to come from somewhere unless we're creating new revenue. And right now our forests obviously are not.
Right.
So I think that type of information is really helpful, and certainly we'll ask you to probably come back and present that in the future.
Okay.
We can meet before then to go over it, because I'm sure you have had to do that analysis as part of your budgeting process.
Yes.
So I think it's part of our job, again, to make sure that when we're saying, yeah, we're going to increase the general fund, I think I read $800,000 in this proposed budget. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it's 1.6 for the biennium.
But for the biennium, 800,000 annually. Right. So we're talking about $1.6 million more in general fund.
Mm-hmm.
What are we getting for those dollars? I think it's an important conversation to have. So
we'll bring that back to you.
And if it's, you know, there's a sweet spot there, I'm guessing of, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of pain.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 800, maybe it's 600, maybe it's 3 million, who knows. But if that comes off the top end, you know, I think that's the value that obviously we're all trying to hit.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that other states, the way that they do it, but the reality is that, you know, we're doing a lot of things differently in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a good thing. I think one of the words that give me the most pause is when I hear, and I fortunately we don't hear it very much anymore, but we've always done it that way, or,
yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. I applaud you, because I think all of the agencies that I work with on the natural resource front are really doing some very innovative work, and certainly with the support of the governor and legislature, and given the limited resources you have to work with, we appreciate that, because we're often asking you to do more with less,
mm-hmm.
and you're actually trying to do more with less.
Mm-hmm.
We do appreciate that. But I think that would be helpful, certainly for the information, to provide that to the committee chair. And I will share it through Beth, and then we'll probably have you come back in the future and present that information.
Excellent. We'll do that. Thank
Pleasure.
You.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, any other final comments before we let you go?
No.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any final comments? All right. With that, this informational hearing is adjourned, and happy holidays to everybody. We'll see